TFM.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I know it's pretty late in the day, but I brought you a big cup of coffee.
Well, Chris, I love that. Thank you so much. You know, I love a well-harvested roast. It's just so delicious. And so, oh, man, I really appreciate that. Normally, at this time of the night, I wouldn't drink coffee. But, you know, I'm going to go ahead. So,
it's interesting that you said well-harvested there, because now I'm thinking that the harvesters that they're trying to get rid of in this episode, is that actually coffee connected? Like, is that like a chain of coffee shops on Talani?
Yeah, like a Starbucks gone wrong.
Starbucks gone wrong. Speaking of Starbucks gone wrong, I don't know if you watch For All Mankind, but in the current season that just ended on Mars, there's actually a Starbucks in Happy Valley.
There and you go. Domino's Pizza. I mean, they're everywhere, man. So
they are everywhere. All right, everyone, we're going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine today. This is season 2, episode 13, Armageddon Game. And here is a quick rundown of the story. Sometimes a good cup of coffee can save the day. It sure does for Miles O'Brien and Julian Bashir when a mission to help two formerly warring civilizations destroy their stockpiles of deadly weapons goes awry. Taking no chances, Kalaran soldiers storm the lab and massacre the science team the moment the last weapon is neutralized. And while Miles and Julian escape, they are reported dead to Deep Space Nine. It's only when Keiko notices on security footage that her husband is drinking coffee in the afternoon, something she believes he never does, that Sisko mounts a mission to find out what is really going on and ultimately rescues his officers. So, Matthew, we have our first Miles and Jules joint of Deep Space Nine. At least I look at it that way. We've had them have a little bit of a story together in The Storyteller back in season 1. Of course, we had Rivals earlier this season, but this is really the first time that the two of them, who will eventually become best friends, really carry an episode on their own together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the hallmarks of this episode, is the way in which these two characters slowly move closer together. You know, It's interesting because, you know, when you write a romance story in television, you kind of have them slowly inch closer and closer together with the stories that you're telling. And with this, you know, they're truly building this friendship in much the same way so many friendships are built. I think in a lot of ways, you know, the Miles and Jules friendship is one that you kind of see play out in many like high school dramas, right? You have those two people. They're on opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, you have the jock and you have the super smart person, and they're not going to be friends. And then they finally find their way to being friends, you know, maybe at the end of the first season or into the second season or something. And that's just what's happening with these two characters. And so I really appreciate the strength of the storytelling here, because as I was rewatching the episode, I was just noticing the ways in which Miles specifically, I think everything that they experience together in this episode helps him see Julian in a light he did not expect, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think when he interacts with Julian, he just expects him to be this brash, bold, obnoxious young man, right? Mm-hmm. And I think he is truly surprised, one, with the revelations that we get about Jules's past.
Yeah.
But two, I think he's actually really surprised that Julian is a decent mechanic himself, you know, that mm-hmm. that he has the ability to understand the directions that he's getting from Miles,
mm-hmm.
the detailed organizational information, and actually able to make it happen. And so, you know, help in, you know, fostering their escape. And so mm-hmm. I think, yeah, this is one of those things where it's like, as I was rewatching this episode, I've seen this episode many times, but I was just struck by how good the writing is when it comes to the most important part of this episode, which is about kind of breaking the wall down between Miles and Julian so that they can become friends in this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason the writing is good here is that the episode is written by Morgan Gendel, who people know best for The Inner Light on The Next Generation. And he also did some other stories. He doesn't have a lot of Star Trek credits, but he did on The Next Generation. He also did Starship Mine. And then he did The Passenger on DS9 earlier before this. But I think that some of what we've seen him do, especially in The Inner Light, kind of comes through in how he handles those character moments a bit here. The fact that Julian can follow, like you're describing, all of this, it makes sense to me because while he's a doctor and we're talking about sort of mechanical engineering things here, I think there's a lot of crossover there in terms of, you know, as a doctor, he's dealing with the body, which is its own mechanical system in a way, and the details that he has to deal with to be able to do his job as a doctor. I think there's a lot of crossover, and maybe that's something that is a reason why there's this synergy ultimately between the two of them, because even though they're in very different fields, there is this connection about how they have to view things and approach things to be successful in their job. And you mentioned Miles being a bit surprised in kind of learning who Bashir really is, as they have to talk a lot in this episode. And it's set up pretty well where initially there's this idea that Bashir's just interested in the women. And mm-hmm. once they start having the conversation, you mentioned we learned some about his background, and we find out that he isn't really just the skirt chaser that he is presented as in season one, and who Miles still kind of sees him as, I guess.
Right.
But there actually is more depth to it. And then, and Bashir actually is, I don't know if jealous is the right word. Does he say that in this episode? But when he looks at Miles and Keiko and the relationship that they have, you know, that's something that he ultimately wants for himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually one of the beauties of this episode, too. I think very few shows at all, these days especially, celebrate the idea of that being married is better than being single, in the mm-hmm. sense of that the adventure that marriage is Miles puts it to Julian, is the greatest adventure, right? And the beauty of it is that you get to do it with somebody else. And yeah, it's hard and frustrating and amazing and joyful and exciting and scary all at the same time. But that's life in general. But you've got this person by your side. And I really appreciated that, because like you said, Julian, you know, beginning to kind of share a little bit more about his experience with, I almost gave up everything I wanted for the person that I loved, and mm-hmm. I didn't. And you can tell that there is this thought in his mind back there somewhere, even though he doesn't audibly say it, that
mm-hmm.
I am kind of wondering if I've made the right decision, right? And mm-hmm. I think, you know, it also explains as to why he's been so keen to, like, try and find a relationship with Dax or somebody, right? Is mm-hmm. because he's in some ways trying to get this previous relationship that meant so much to him out of his mind. And again, the way in which the writing has kind of picked up on all these little bits of these characters, especially Julian, to flesh mm-hmm. out this person and make him more fully rounded. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly well done, and the fact that they do it in one episode is yeah. awesome, but it also is one of those things where it's like, this is truly what it means to write episodic television in the sense that this is the second season. So we get to take all the stuff we know about this character and thrust them forward with a well-written episode that opens up a lot of doors for the character of Julian and Miles, their friendship, and a lot of other stuff, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Another interesting twist to this pairing that we end up with in this episode is that originally the idea was to pair Bashir with Jadzia instead of Miles, which I suppose makes sense on the surface with what they're trying to achieve with the weapon, because you would have Jadzia there as a scientist. So you've got a doctor and then you've got scientists together as opposed to a doctor and an engineer. But there was this feeling that, well, you know, we've been playing around with this Bashir-Jadzia pairing for a long time. Let's do something different. So they ended up making it Miles, which I think gave us a much better story and a very different story than we would have gotten, and one that pays off a lot more as the series goes on. But you mentioned, as we were talking on the other side of the orb, that we do see in this episode that Jadzia seems to have a bit more feelings for Bashir than she normally lets on. And I wonder if some of that might be a residual effect from the original idea of pairing them on this mission for this episode. And that's the reason that it remains in the story.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question because, you know, the beauty of the conversation that, you know, Jadzia and Kira have, you know, she lets Kira know that, you know, he had given her his medical journals when he was in medical school and she hasn't read them yet, but he had given her those so that she could understand him more. And even just the way that she describes them, it mm-hmm. helps us see a character who is quite different than the facade that we have. And I think, again, that that's just really, really interesting because the beauty of this is like so many shows, right? You watch, especially sitcoms, they fall into this trap. You write a character and in the end, that character, if that show lasts for many years, they end up kind of becoming the worst version of their most outrageous traits, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Friends is like this. You look at Ross as a character. Mm-hmm. By the end of that show, he's just a caricature of himself because you just mm-hmm. write to the things that quote-unquote people find the funniest. The beauty here, though, is that we have this character who has this, you know, facade that we've all seen, but instead of just writing to the facade, what we're doing is we're uncovering the layers so that we can truly kind of dig into who this character is. And that is what is going to make them interesting. And I really appreciate that. I think it's just incredibly smart here because, and that's the thing that is immediately, you know, we talk about the ways in which this show, Deep Space Nine, is setting itself apart from TNG. This is one of the ways. We're specifically with the character of Julian here. We're taking a character and we've given you more backstory in this one episode for this character than you got mm-hmm. in like 5 seasons, 6, sometimes 7 seasons for TNG characters. I think that's pretty incredible. It really shows that the writers want this show to be different. They want it to feel different. And they what they want is for you to feel like you are knowing these characters. And man, that's exciting stuff, right? Like, because that's what makes for good television, you know? Those are the shows we keep going back to.
Right. You know, I started to say that it shows the evolution of TV writing, but actually there's not a lot of separation time. And in fact, at this point, you've still got both series going. So there's an overlap of TNG and DS9. And or you've just, this was January 94. So I guess you just kind of, you're finishing. So, but what's interesting is a lot of the writers, a lot of the people involved, there is an overlap between the two series. And so what I think you see more happening is that Deep Space Nine gave them an opportunity to break out of the Roddenberry box of what he saw Star Trek as being and open it up more and develop the characters more and have conflict between the characters. Or even if it's not conflict, but it's like uneasy moments that are more, that expose the inner workings of the character's thoughts in a way that you didn't see in the framework that TNG was built upon.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is one of those episodes that shows you that Deep Space Nine, no pun intended, is charting its own course when it comes to Star Trek storytelling, especially as we've known it in the TNG era, you know, and that we're going to do our own thing. And I love that because the relationship between Miles and Julian is just one of the best relationships in Star Trek. It's one of the best friendships in Star Trek. You know, everybody thinks of Kirk and Spock and McCoy, right? But honestly, you know, this relationship, this friendship rivals that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I would argue that we actually get a deeper, better understood friendship here than we do with Kirk and Spock and McCoy because the writing allows us to do that, right? And I would say, too, most of the relational writing for those characters really only happened in the six movies, you know, and actually not even six. It's really five that they get. And so... it's predicated off of some of the stuff you got in the show. But yeah, here, the beauty is this is the second season of this show and we're digging into characters and not even that, but like one of the points that you made, like Keiko's a character that, man, she is touch and go with fans, right? Like people either really hate Keiko or they like, but this is one of those episodes where I think the relational bond between Miles and Keiko comes to the forefront. And it's just so beautifully done because it highlights the beauty and the joy of being married. And being married saves their lives, right? Like and of course it's turned into an enjoyable joke at the end of the episode. But I really like how we get to utilize a character that we don't get to utilize a ton in the series in Keiko here. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's always nice when they can find something for her to do in the story that matters for the story. And we've talked about before how because they brought Miles over from the Next Generation, they had to bring Keiko over. So then they always struggle to figure out what to have her do on the station. But here, yeah, it makes perfect sense. And it also works because what we're dealing with Miles and Julian is so personal. And the conversation actually touches on the marriage aspect of Miles's life. So it's a perfect fit to have Keiko play an important part in figuring out what's actually going on. Now, it's funny that she's actually wrong. Keiko's hunch is wrong that he does drink coffee in the afternoon sometimes, but that's okay. You know, we all have that situation where we think we know something about our partner that maybe isn't quite accurate, or they would say, of course, I always drink this or eat this or or do this. So, yeah, so it felt real, right? I mean, that's real. If it had been perfectly on the nose, then it would feel like it's just put there purely for the plot, right? So I think that having it be wrong in the end, it feels real. So I like that part. And I'm glad that she had something real to do in the story.
No, I completely agree. And again, I think so much of our world has become about this expressive individualism that I think is ruining the joys of something like being married. And the ways in which that's actually good for us. I mean, you know, there's so many studies about the health benefits, especially for men, of being in a marriage. And so, like, I just really appreciate this episode for that. You know, we just don't get to see that a lot. And I think that's one of the beauties of Deep Space Nine that we've talked about so many times is the ways in which this show looks at a lot of different sides of life that we don't really get to see in other Star Trek series. Like, I mean, you know, we've talked about many times, this show is about what it means to be a father because of Sisko.
Mm-hmm.
This show, of course, it becomes about what it means to have friends across a variety of spectrums, right? You, when it comes to like friends, like you think of Jadzia and Quark, or even Jadzia and Kira, two totally different type of people, right? And yet mm-hmm. they come together. And so I think that that's on display in this episode too, because the main part of the story is about Miles and Julian, two people on very different spectrums, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who are slowly coming together as friends. And I think it's pretty great, man. Mm-hmm. It leads me to, like, when I rewatch an episode like this, as we're doing this rewatch, I'm like, gosh, this is just good stuff, you know? Like, you're just struck by, because, you know, mm-hmm. I'm really sitting down and watching it, and I'm trying to soak it in, because I'm trying to kind of not even just see it from previous perspective, but I'm trying to let it hopefully show me something that I maybe haven't seen before. And yeah, I was just really struck by all of those things in this episode. And that's exciting for an episode that I've probably seen a dozen times, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, I'm thinking the concept of this episode, the idea that we have Starfleet officers who go to a place to help two warring alien races who are trying to disarm themselves, and the Federation has decided to help. And then something happens to our heroes, to our characters, and we have to figure out what's going on and then retrieve them. Like, that whole plot, that could be a TOS episode. That could be a TNG episode leading up to this point. And then later in time, it could be a Voyager episode, right? But the difference here is that even though that whole framework, you could easily tell mm-hmm. that story on one of those other series, that's not the approach they take. They make it all about the characters instead. And that framework is just there to drive the character interactions. So, well, speaking of that plot, however, a core point of this story from a social standpoint is to kill all the scientists. They've decided that it's not enough to disarm. It's not enough to get rid of all the weapons. Anybody who has any knowledge of how these weapons were created, who might know how to build them again, everyone has to die. And do you think that is a justifiable way for a society to function and to treat its people? And is it even practical to do that?
I mean, that's a loaded question. And I feel like, to me, the answer is no. I think the interesting aspect of this is, you know, the idea of creating a weapon of mass destruction that's so dangerous, you know, we don't want anybody to have access to ever remaking it ever. I get that, right? but to go about it in this way, I mean, it's just more, you're basically trying to have two wrongs make a right. And that's just not possible, mm-hmm. right? That's not how it works. And I think that's the thing that is seen in the episode, right? And what's interesting about this is that we actually never deal with the ramifications of these people, right? We never see what happens to them. We never see what happens to their planet. But we're just left with, I think, this question in the episode that I think if the episode was just slightly better in the sense of writing, it would leave a question as to, does this behavior lead to somebody finding out about this at some point and it blowing up in their faces,
mm-hmm.
right? And creating another schism because we see them as untrustworthy. Right. We see the people who are our leaders mm-hmm. as having done something morally irrehensible. Right. And in the name of quote unquote, you know, good. But again, what about the families of the victims, you know? And so, like, mm-hmm. no, I don't think this is justified. I do think that you're kind of left in the episode with kind of wondering, oh, my gosh, what is going to happen to these people?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also dangerous for a society to take that approach because when you deal with science, anything can be used for good or bad. And just the knowledge itself has potential, like has value for good or for bad uses. And if you look at, you know, what we came to understand that allowed the atomic bomb to be created. Yes, the atomic bomb is a terrible thing, but the knowledge that led to that has also led to many benefits for society in other areas that the scientific foundation for how things work on an atomic level and a quantum level. And, you know, here we're dealing with a biological weapon. Well, the knowledge that can be used to create a biological weapon can also be used to save lives. So if you kill all the scientists, if you destroy all the knowledge down the road, something might come along dealing with biology here. Something could come from nature that wipes out your civilization because you killed all of the smartest people, all the scientists yeah. who actually had the knowledge yeah, that could have saved you from it in the first place. So, you know, it's a very, you know, to take that kind of black and white approach to something like this, I get it from a science fiction standpoint of suggesting that a society might do this. But of course, in putting that into the story, you're asking the question of like, yeah. would that be yeah. the right thing to do? And while, yeah, I can understand the thought process of some of the people that are deciding that, hey, we got to kill everybody. Those people making that decision are not the smartest people that you would want to be in control of your society.
Well, I think that we see this in our world, right? You know, when people try to do something of this nature, and basically what they're trying to do is to make two wrongs out of a right and then explain it away. We don't like that. You know, nobody's like, oh man, that was such a great idea. I'm so mm-hmm. glad you did that. Right. You know, and I think that's where we mm-hmm. end up here. And it is one of those things where I almost kind of wish we had gotten the opportunity to revisit this planet and see the repercussions of this action. But I do think the episode mm-hmm. leaves it well enough that you're like, dang, I think they've got a problem on their hands at some point. And I think it also does a good job. And I think this is one of the places where this show has only grown in the sense that I think we see this type of behavior all throughout our world today. And mm-hmm. I like being confronted with an incredibly important question to ask, mm-hmm. to be asked,
Yeah.
And really have to deal with the ramifications of this type of question. I think that's good.
Well, let me ask you about the original concept, which would have focused specifically on Miles. So it's still about killing people, but Morgan Gandell's original idea was a little bit more personal, a little bit more intense, and maybe a little bit more in the vein of the let's torture O'Brien theme that ends up running through a lot of Deep Space Nine. The idea would have been that the aliens had encoded the, I guess, the schematics of the weapon into Miles's DNA. So the only way to get rid of it would have been to kill Miles. And so they would have been demanding to the Federation that the Federation get rid of this for them. And so the Federation would have had to decide to kill one of its officers to help this alien race because it's in his DNA. So obviously that would have been a very different story. And we may have, although not necessarily, lost out on the whole Miles and Julian friendship interaction, that element of the story. Although that could have still played out because maybe Bashir would have been trying to figure out a way to extract it from the DNA, for example, so that it could be destroyed separately. But what do you think about that concept?
I think it's an interesting idea. And I think, though, that I find myself thankful that that's not what we got. I think that what we got was more interesting because it was more about the characters than it was kind of a possible interesting moral question, if that makes sense. You know, I like that this is a character-focused story instead of that. I also think that the storyline, you know, Starfleet's never going to kill one of their own members. Like, I think that's the thing where it's like, that's too far-fetched for that to even be the case. And so that couldn't be.
And you can't kill Miles because he's a main character on the show.
So that can't be what the episode's going to be about. So the episode would be about trying to find a way then to save him. And so.
Yeah.
I just don't, you know, I don't buy that part as a storyline. So I think that the original idea being transformed into what we got was actually just a better choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so as well. I think, yeah, I mean, again, from a science fiction perspective, if you were writing not Star Trek, but you're writing general SF, then that idea of a weapon schematics being encoded in someone's DNA and ultimately potentially resulting in their death to save others, it's an interesting concept. But yeah, I don't think it would work for Star Trek, especially not in the second season of a show where you're dealing with one of your main characters and one of the most beloved characters in the show at this point, because we've already been living with them on TNG for so many years. All right. Well, what are your final thoughts on this one, and what's your rating going to be?
Yeah, this is such a solid episode. And I don't really think I have anything to add to what we've talked about other than to say, you know, this is probably a great 4 out of 5. Like, this is one of those, I think, episodes that's wonderfully rewatchable in this season, right? Because it is one that you can just pop in because it's so character focused, you know, and it then makes it wonderful in the rewatch, right? Because you're reminded of these moments where these characters are connecting in this way, which then remind you of all the other moments of what comes next, you know, when you've seen the show previously. So yeah, I think this is an absolute 4 out of 5 for me. 4 out of 5 harvester drops. Be real careful with that stuff, man. You don't want to get it on your skin. But what about you, Chris?
Yeah. I did want to mention that, well, there are a few things. One is that we do get to see Akeleron again later on in Star Trek. This is kind of an odd episode. It was for me when they revealed this for them to go back to. But in Discovery Season 5, you have Commander Raynor, who is a Starfleet officer, a main character, who is Akeleron.
Oh, interesting.
In the 32nd century, so way down the line, but his view of things is influenced a little bit by his people's history with the Talani and this conflict that we see in Armageddon Game. So that was kind of a deep cut that they went there. It was an unexpected one.
Are you saying that the first cut is the deepest?
The first cut is the deepest. Maybe. Yeah. That might tie into our what we talked about before we started recording today. So, anyway, I also wanted to mention that Serac Lofton does not appear in this episode.
It's true.
So I'm sure you remember, Matthew, especially years ago in the Orb, we used to often joke about how there are many episodes that are flagged as Serac Lofton does not appear in this episode.
It's very true.
And that's often paired with the same thing that applies to this episode, directed by Winrich Kolbe. So, don't know why, but we've got that pairing here. And then the last thing is kind of funny, but it also makes sense. Armageddon Game was nominated for an Emmy Award for Outstanding Individual Achievement in Hairstyling for a Series in 1994.
That's not surprising. There's some interesting hairstyles in this. We'll just say
very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, the Kelleran and the Talani, obviously, together with the Bajoran militia, they're keeping the hair product industry in business.
Absolutely.
And I love the fact that like they both have crazy hairstyles. But the difference is one race, they like to do two spikes and the other race likes to do one spike. That way you can keep them apart.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important. You know, Chris. Who's who. It's so important. It's very important. You know, you got to keep them separated.
Yeah. Got to keep them separated. So those are the things that I wanted to mention at the end. But yeah, like you said, I think it's a really good episode. It finds a good balance between being an episodic style Star Trek story compared with what we get these days and still digging into the characters and giving us many, many meaningful moments that will pay off throughout the series. So it's not isolated just to what happens in this one episode. So you can always look back and remember that moment when they talked about this or they learned this thing about each other. So I think it works really well for that. So I'm actually going to give this one 8 ballet dancers, a rating that Bashir really loves.
Nice.
It's like a dream come true for Bashir.
Absolute dream come true.
Yeah. All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Armageddon Game. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email, go to our website. Our new website is online now. It's tfm.fan. So that's tfm.fan/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Orb, and that will come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not trying to get Dr. Bashir to stop talking, if only for a moment, where can people find you?
I'm exhausted. Well, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, outside all the great Star Trek talk we do, you can find me on the 602 Club talking about all the other franchises we love. So please check that out. And then I'm over on the Nerd Party Network with a couple of shows. One is called Outpost, about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and Aggressive Negotiations, as John Mills and I talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to figure out, you know, what time of the day is too late for you to drink coffee, where can people find you?
It's interesting. And like Miles, I have a Japanese wife as well. So it all ties together in this episode, that whole thing. But when I'm not running that test on myself, You can find me elsewhere on the network, of course, doing all the shows with you. You can find me in the back catalog on a lot of shows from the last 16 years, talking about a wide range of Star Trek topics. And you can also catch Larry Nemechek and me sometimes on The Ready Room. And in social media, you can find me pretty much everywhere. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky's where I'm most active, but you can find me everywhere, so please do drop me a line. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support, so thank you so much to everyone who is helping us now. Well, Matthew, I hope you're looking forward to putting Miles through the ringer again next time as we talk about Whispers.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to see what happens. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.
Record.
Recording.
Recording.
Miles sick pants.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Miles is can't stand up pants.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Hope he didn't have to use the bathroom during this time.
Yeah, that's lucky. Although maybe he had rigged up some like little transporter to just beam it out so he doesn't have to worry about any accidents.
That's probably what they do, sir. You're giving me a poop question?
That's probably what they do. Like, you never see anybody go to the bathroom on Star Trek, right?
It's true.
They probably have like some little like sanitary transporters or something like that.
You just hit the button and it beams the poop out.
That's right. Yeah. You know, sometimes when they tap their badge, but they're not actually calling anybody and you wonder what they're doing.
That's what it is. Yeah.
That's what it is, right?
It's the poop transporter.
Yeah. You know, sometimes like the Borg come on the screen and like five people on the bridge all tap their badge at the same time.
I got to clean up on aisle five.
Yeah, you know what's going
on. Ding, 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 right? I got a full one.
Yeah, you hear like Geordi calling up, going like, Captain, the transporter buffer is overflowing right now. We can't beam anybody in or out.
Oh, this man. Transporter's full of shit.
Oh, man. That could be one of those fake episode titles that's been going around in social media with those memes with the title screen generator that someone created.
Yeah, all right. That's funny.
All right. Let's get into this. Okay, here we go.